Good morning, everyone, and thank you for your patience on this typical winter morning in Minnesota. What we're going to do today, and I know that there are cameras here, probably not to hear what we're going to do here first this morning, but I've talked to several of our members. They're running very late, and so what we're going to do is we're going to go ahead and reverse the order of things this morning. We're going to hear from Minkoji this morning first and have their presentation. And then the plan would be if we don't have enough members here to hear the other two bills, then we will recess and come back this evening in light of the weather conditions. So with that, the first order of business before we get started would be the approval of the minutes. Do I have anyone that would like to move the minutes? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Before we get to the minutes, I just have a question. So we currently have a quorum in the committee. So I just want to get clarification. So we're going to come back tonight if you don't have enough members to pass the bills, because we currently have a quorum in order to hear these bills and vote on them. Is that what I heard you say?
My intention is to hear the presentation from Minkoji, and hopefully other members will get here, because other members will want to have participation in the discussion on these bills. So Representative Howe, would you like to move the minutes from January 5th?
Yes, Madam Chair. So moved.
Thanks. Any discussion on the minutes? Seeing none, all those in favor of approving the minutes of January 5th, please respond by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Minutes are approved. Is Mr. Ealing here yet? Oh, there he is. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Ealing.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, my name is Matt Ealing with the Minnesota Coalition on Government Information. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning, and what I really want to talk about this morning is the Data Practices Act and the value that it provides to Minnesota citizens in terms of providing government transparency. You heard a little bit about this last week. We wanted to give some real-world examples of how this helps out the citizens of the state. For those of you who are not familiar with our organization, we're a nonpartisan, nonprofit, all-volunteer group that's comprised of people who use government information on a routine basis. We've been advocates for government transparency and accountability here at the Capitol for over a decade, and we've provided public education about access to government data since 1989. And our advocacy is really aimed at ensuring that citizens have access to government information to facilitate a functional democracy. And here at the Capitol, that really that work surrounds Chapter 13, the Data Practices Act. That's primarily what we're working on. Now, as you've heard, Chapter 13 is Minnesota's principal law that regulates government information, among a couple of other laws. One of the things that it does, one of its primary functions, is to provide the public with direct access to government data. Now, like all laws, it's a series of technical regulations, but it's really a story. And the development of that story has been driven by human need and human experience over decades. And it's that human experience that I want to highlight today. If you look at page 3 of your packet, you're going to see a picture of John Finnegan. Mr. Finnegan was the former editor of the Pioneer Press newspaper, and along with other press figures of the 1970s and various legislators, he spurred the creation of the Data Practices Act as we know it today. And so he worked to put in law this idea that government data should be broadly accessible to the public. Now, as a newsman, Mr. Finnegan, he understood the value of government data to reportage, but he looked more broadly. He understood that there's a value to the public in having access to this stuff. And so he and his allies worked to make Minnesota's open records law useful to the entire body politic, and the state legislature agreed with that approach. Now, the reasons why lawmakers of the 1970s adopted the Data Practices Act are really twofold. And the first involved very practical issues, and that practical issue primarily was that government data at the time was not broadly accessible to the public. Outside of lawsuits, there was no regulated legal mechanism for citizens to acquire government information. And this had also been the case at the federal level, and you saw this spur the adoption of the Freedom of Information Act at the federal level in 1966. After that happened, you saw states then follow suit, and they each adopted their own version of open records laws, and we adopted the Minnesota Data Practices Act in its final form here in the late 1970s. Now, the second reason why the Data Practices Act and similar laws were adopted really goes to the growing complexity of society and the growing complexity of government regulation of what was going on in society. And you don't have to look very far back in the life or family history of anybody in this room to get to pretty humble circumstances and a lot simpler society. You look back prior to World War II, a lot of folks didn't have telephones. If you're living in a rural area in parts of the country, you might not have had electrical service. After the war, things changed dramatically. You had booming economic growth that drove the development of complex technology, and as society became more complex, you look at something as simple as television. To make television function, you needed a government regulatory structure to make sure that the signals didn't interfere with each other. So as you had this growing complexity in society, you had more complex government operations, and over time, people all across the political spectrum in the country wanted to get more access to information about how this government was touching their lives. And that's what really spurred the creation of these open records laws. Now, a little bit to how Chapter 13, the Minnesota Government Data Practices Act, functions. As you probably heard last week in iPad's presentation, the Data Practices Act makes all government data available to the public unless the legislature specifically classifies it as otherwise due to some legitimate need to protect specific information. So the exceptions to public access need to be specific. That was the way it was set out in the 1970s. And so this broad-based access to government data and its detailed regulation by the legislature, these were really breaks from past practice that were dramatic. And John Finnegan and his allies were told many times by the government officials of his day that this approach was impractical, that nobody needed access to the data, and that this was just simply never going to work. 40 years later, that law is still in the books. It still provides access to the citizens of the state to give them access to government data to this very day. So what I want to turn to now is a few examples of why the statute is valuable to the citizens of Minnesota. And the first examples I want to turn to will be familiar because you see them in your headlines every day. If you turn to page 6 of our packet, we can look at a recent headline. This is a story from the Star Tribune, and it deals with the use of U.S. Bank Stadium box seats controlled by the Minnesota Sports Facilities Authority. It's a publicly funded agency. And the Star Tribune was able to secure the names of persons, including various public officials, who had been given free access to these suites for sporting events and concerts, so they didn't have to pay for the tickets like the general public would. Now, after news coverage of this was revealed, most of those folks then paid for the ticket price in the wake of the news coverage. And this story got a lot of attention, but it's important to peel back the top of it and look at how this story came to be. The only reason why the names of those public officials were provided to the Star Tribune was because their government data made public by the Data Practices Act. If you look on page 7, we can look back 10 years to another example, the collapse of the I-35W bridge. This was an event that had a real and tragic impact in terms of the loss of human life, and the public had a great stake in understanding what issues led to the collapse, as well as what other bridges might need repair or replacement at the time. And again, how did the press start to dig into the story? All of the data was held by MnDOT and other government agencies. It's public data obtained through the Data Practices Act. If you look at page 8, beyond the press, the public itself, as I've mentioned, is a tremendous user of information provided through Chapter 13. And we have a pulse on this activity due to the fact that we answer questions on almost a weekly basis from citizens who contact us with questions about how to get access to government data. And the range of individuals and organizations we've encountered includes really the whole spectrum of human experience. People seeking old police reports because they want to get expungements, people seeking federal grant data related to autism studies because they have an autistic child, people seeking municipal utility records. It goes on and on. And the range of organizations spans the whole political spectrum, from the Minnesota Taxpayers League to various environmental groups. Now, on page 8, one notable citizen request that I was involved with involved a woman from Duluth. And she learned that the county was going to do a road repair project that would essentially take down all the old-growth trees that lined her street that she and her neighbors really enjoyed. And she made a data request and found out more about the construction project. And through her request, she was able to learn that the county had actually studied alternate means of doing this road repair that wouldn't necessarily take out all the trees. So then she could take that information, talk to her city council people, and start to move the process in a different direction. And this is an important example because it's instructive in that it shows how the Data Practices Act really levels the playing field between government agencies that hold information and citizens who would not have access to that same information. They're impacted by it, but they wouldn't have access to it if it wasn't for Chapter 13. That's why it's so important to be there. On page 9, you'll see an example that some of you were directly involved in. Citizens have also used the Data Practices Act to affect change here at the legislature, and you see this year after year by folks doing their own research and bringing that research into the legislative process. So 3 years ago, we saw Mr. Neumeister, who I think I saw him earlier, a very experienced data requester. He discovered through Data Practices Act requests that Minnesota law enforcement agencies were using so-called Stingray devices to capture cell phone location information. And there was no specific regulatory framework to address these devices at the time. And the reason why is because the legislature did not know that these devices were being used. It had never been told by law enforcement. So once this information was given to the press, given to lawmakers, and then they could make an informed decision, and they ultimately passed a warrant requirement for the use of these devices. Legislators, and some of you know this from direct experience.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The warrant requirement we passed, how many of those warrants have been disclosed so far?
Mr. Ely?
None have been disclosed so far.
Oh, okay. Thanks. I just want
to weigh in on that. I got that on the record.
Thank you for the indulgence, Madam Chair.
You're welcome. Mr. Ely, go ahead.
Thank you for the question, Representative Lesh. So legislators, as well as the public and the press, are also frequent users of this law, and we've seen this from ourselves. Every year we get questions from lawmakers on both sides of the aisle seeking information, asking how to get a hold of it as they formulate their future lawmaking. Now, I would note that one of the principal strengths of the way our law is written is that it gives you access not only to the final outcome of government decisions, like a final city budget, but it also gives you access to data that underlies the process of how decisions were made. And that gets to this leveling of the playing field in terms of the power relationship between citizens and the government. It's important to have access to the final product, but you need access to the process as well. And we have, again, another very example kind of close to home here. If you look at page 11 of our packet, in 2012, the Minnesota legislature passed legislation that required the Department of Human Services to hire an independent contractor to prepare a report on the value of managed care organizations to the state's public health care programs. And there had been a lot of discussion and debate in the 2 years prior to this about how managed care organizations were handling these programs, what were they doing with taxpayer money, and this report was part of the legislative inquiry into that issue. Now, if you look at page 12, you'll see an email. And this was an email that came through a data request into the process of writing that report. And in this email from DHS, a DHS staffer asks an agency official about the contractor that they had hired wanting to use input from critics of managed care operations in the report. And then the DHS official replies to their staffer, and they said, here is the list of people you do not talk to. And that list included Sean Nenow, who was then a sitting Minnesota senator, and a member of the legislature who had commissioned the report. So that's why it's important to have access to process-based data. And it's important also to highlight the fact that this information came in the form of an email, because that's going to be part of the discussion here this year. Legislators from both sides of the aisle are discussing ways to improve the retention of electronic government records like this one. So these are examples of why the Data Practices Act is important to the public, to the press, to legislators. As I've said, this is a detailed law that gets revisited every year. And changes are made year to year. There are requests to make certain government data not public that come up from time to time. And what we would do is ask all of you to keep in mind, as you evaluate those requests, the principles that guided the creation of this law to begin with, the principles that John Finnegan and his allies in the legislature brought for the 1970s legislature. And the underlying principle is that the door to government operations should be open to the public. And we'd ask you to keep that in mind, because if the legislature of the 1970s had not kept that in mind, all of the data that I've shown to you in all these examples would not have been available to the public today. So thank you very much for your time. I'd be happy to stand for questions.
Member questions?
I have a question, Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you. And thank you for your testimony. Mr. Ayling, this is, I think, an area of the legislature that a policy up here that a lot of folks, when you start talking about it, their eyes roll over into the back of their head, and they're like, do we really have to deal with this? But when you see the real implications of it, it's quite pronounced. And oftentimes, it's the press that's the greatest defender of our right to information, and they've had sort of an easier job in Minnesota, I think, than they have had in a lot of other states. You saw, I was watching closely during the Bridgegate out in New Jersey when Chris Christie punished the mayor by closing an exit or something. I'm not even sure exactly what happened there. The point was they couldn't get any of the information. Nobody knew what went on, and Chris Christie and his underlings or whatever were able to successfully hide that because no one could disclose what had went on. What do you see as the biggest changes, differences between Minnesota and other states in terms of our citizens' access to information about the government?
Mr. Ealing?
Thank you, Representative Lesh. New Jersey is a great example of how we have such a better law than other states. New Jersey and some other states have either implemented in statute or courts have developed this idea that there are requests that are burdensome or overly complex. And they use that as a cudgel to wield against the requesters. I make, myself, outside of Minkoji, I make data requests all over the country, and so I have a sense of how these statutes stack up. I've made requests to Governor Christie's office where you cannot get very, very basic information. It's hard to get a staff list of people that work there, because every time you put in a request, they say, your request is too complex, it's barred by the state statute or this case law. And so that's why having the legislature in very minute, finite detail deal with what's public and not public in Minnesota is such a better situation.
Is there, Representative
Mr. Ayling, are there any other states, what other states do you know of that are like Minnesota where the default classification of our data is public?
Mr. Ayling?
Most state open records law will have that public default. The problem is that a lot of other states will either have very broad-based exemptions. So, for instance, they'll have exemptions that say that deliberative process information is exempt. So that would knock out a lot of the process-based data that we've talked about. So you can get the final report, for instance, but you can't get the internal agency correspondence. So that's the problem in a lot of other states.
So, Madam Chair and Mr. Ayling, the exceptions swallow the rule in those cases. So what you're saying is Minnesota, at least so far, not quite as bad insofar as the exceptions that have swallowed that rule of everything's public?
Mr. Ayling?
Our experience and my personal experience looking comparatively is that we have one of the best laws in the country. The challenges in Minnesota always lie in making sure it's implemented properly, making sure the agencies are responding properly.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason I ask that question is every session, and now we're data practices, and I actually don't know the legislative history of House Rule 4.16, Madam Chair, and how long it's been on the books, where if you have data in your bill, it has to come to this committee. I think it goes back about maybe like 8 years or something. But the reason it started back then was because all of a sudden big data started to become a major issue, not just with respect to government, but with the private sector too. We all saw the consequences of the Target data breach, and they lost a CEO who lost a pretty sweet gig after that one. But Minnesota has that same situation. The problem is when these bills come through here, members, they're all asking us to classify that data to either a confidential or private status where you can't get to it. And so you start to pick away at this until our law is not as good. And I think it's interesting, normally when citizens come in to testify about their particular area of expertise, they're saying that Minnesota is worse than other states, which is why we need this change. Okay, and notice, this is one of the few times you'll hear this, someone come in and say Minnesota is better than other states, which means we have to hang on to this designation, and it's really up to this committee to do that. Thank you, Mr. Ehling.
Thank you. Mr. Ehling, do you have any follow-up comments on that? You know, just this either last night or this morning, I heard on the news that I believe it was the ACLU asked, or they had a petitioned the court to have the video, the body cam, or the dash cam video of the ordeal that we had last year with Mr. Castile's death, and they had asked the courts to produce that, and the judge came back and said that it's still under investigation, and so they denied that request. So, members, that is one caveat or one carve out in our law, is that if it's classified as investigative data, that at that time it is not public. Ordinarily, that kind of data would be public. And right now, dash cam video is public. And I think, Mr. Ehling, if you could speak to the virtues of keeping that public, that would be helpful.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Dash cam video falls under Section 1382, which regulates access to law enforcement data. So it is presumptively public data unless you have, for instance, an ongoing criminal investigation. So it's public before, and then it's public afterwards once the investigation is closed. The legislature, interestingly enough, if you look at the history of the dash cams, they made a very deliberate determination back about 15 years ago, because there was a squad car grant program that the legislature put money into to allow agencies some money to put video cameras in squad cars, because there had been a debate about police conduct at the time. And so this was looked at as, here's a solution that we can try to implement so that people can see what conduct is occurring. And they crossed the threshold of doing that and decided to keep all that data public. And so that was a determination made at that time, because it's a video documenting a public officer performing a public function. And so that's the value of having that stuff as a public record.
Thank you for that. Also in the news a lot recently is actually two issues. One of different government entities having meetings and trying to get around an open meeting law. And so that's a different area of statute, the open meeting law. But if you could address that, particularly for the new members on this committee that may not be familiar with that, and how that works, and maybe if it needs to be strengthened or if it's fine the way it is.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, this is an issue that we're looking at making a modification in this session. We'd like to see the legislature take some action. The open meeting law predates the Data Practices Act. It doesn't deal with necessarily government data. It does in some tangential way, but it mostly deals with making sure the public can actually physically walk into a meeting of public officials. And for, let me put it this way, the change that we're looking to facilitate is that there's an old Supreme Court case law from 1983 that hasn't really been utilized until very recently. And what happened recently, in the city I live, St. Paul, the St. Paul School Board, they had petitioned to hold a meeting between all the members of the school board, because apparently the school board members were having acrimonious relations. They wanted to bring in a mediator to try to work out their differences. They didn't want to do it in public, so they petitioned to get an exception to the open meeting law. And they relied on this 1983 Supreme Court case that defines a meeting, a public meeting, as a meeting where official business is conducted. So they said, what we're doing is not official business, the public can't come in, and that's been their position. So we think that's very problematic, because again, that can be one of those things that's the exception swallowing the whole. So we'd like to see a definition added to the open meeting law that essentially exempts that official business language, so that anytime you have a quorum of folks in the school board or city council, that's a de facto open meeting. It doesn't matter what they're doing. We don't want to provide them a way to stuff official business into non-official business meetings.
Thank you. And then the other issue that's been in the news lately is data retention, with certain entities wanting to keep their email, for instance, for only 30 days. And so does Minkoji have a preference on how long that data should be kept, or what's Minkoji's stand on that issue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. We have two interrelated thoughts on this. One is, again, there's an old Supreme Court case from 1968 that's kind of laid in the weeds for a long time that I think the legislature needs to address. And what that Supreme Court case said was that there are certain government records that are official, and there's certain government records that are not official, and you don't need to retain the non-official government records. And where you started to see problems with that emerge is in email retention. So you see various municipalities trying to rely on that argument now to get rid of email faster. The governor's office over several decades now has relied on that so that they don't have to keep emails that they don't consider to be official records. And this goes back to the Ventura administration. They're all using the same rationale. So we'd like to see that addressed. And then if there's going to be a statutory minimum for email put in, I think the place to start the discussion is at about a three-year time period, because if you look at existing records retention schedules, and every government agency has a retention schedule they operate with to show them how long to keep different pieces of data, many of them say 3 years is the retention period for general correspondence, and we would consider email to fall squarely in that.
Thank you for that. Any other member questions for Mr. Ealing? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Ealing, in kind of making that call about the 3 years, to what extent have you considered the, I mean, has storage costs factored into your decision on that at all? And if so, how much, in what way?
Mr. Ealing?
That is an area where I think we would welcome information being brought into the process. The typical resistance by government agencies to holding on to records longer or to even complying with the Data Practices Act has been arguments of cost. It's too costly, it's too burdensome. And we ask for data on this, but we get a lot of anecdotal arguments. So I think that if people are going to make that cost argument, we'd like to see some hard data to start that discussion.
Well, Madam Chair, one of the issues we run into here is Moore's Law, which states that the number of transistors per square inch on integrated circuits doubles every certain amount of time, which brings the cost of storing down. And we have to budget for two-year cycles. And when we set up a law for data retention, we're not setting it up for 2 years. We're setting up for, you know, who knows, however long the technology remains viable. And so the numbers of what that's going to cost an agency or a local unit of government in the next biennium may be very different from what it costs 5 or 10 years down the road. And that's something that's been really difficult to grapple with, because I think the storage question is a legitimate question. So just heads up for members of the committee who are thinking about that. It's one of the major issues, but a major issue because it's so variable. We can't get our hands wrapped around how much this is going to cost, and that is a big factor in its viability.
And also on that note of data storage, we have not only the storage of the government's data that should be made public, but the government has certain data on us too, and they seem to want to keep that long. And storage doesn't seem to be quite as big of an issue when it comes to that side. So we want to make sure that that's a balanced approach. And I appreciate you being here, Mr. Ealing. Any other questions from members? Representative Howe.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess I got a question as far as when we have physical paper storage and when we have electronic storage, the difference between that and what happens if the government entity changes it from the physical storage, scans it in that matter, or has duplicate copies, electronic and physical, and decides to destroy the physical to keep the electronic version. Is there differences there, or does that shift any burden anywhere?
Mr. Ealing?
Right now, the records management statute and the schedules that it creates are organized by the content of the information. So you can have situations where you have paper files that are scanned and then retained. If it's general correspondence, you would retain it for 3 years, for instance, and it wouldn't matter the format. What we're trying to address is people trying to find the wiggle room where they can classify stuff as not official and throw it out. That's the issue we're trying to get at.
Question. Any other questions from members? Thank you. I believe Mr. Neumeister has a few words for us. Thank you, Mr. Ealing, for being here.
Madam Chair, for the record, my name is Rick Neumeister. I'll just be less than 5 minutes. The point was is that you all had a general presentation about the Data Practices Act from a venue from a resident, a citizen, trying to get access to public information. But another very important part of the Data Practices Act has put it into action is called Fair Information Principles. And you have that in your packet. And it's very important part of it, particularly as Madam Chair indicated, about all the information that government collects about us, we as individuals. Government has gotten bigger over the last 50 years. And I head out to Washington, D.C. in a couple of days. I've seen the growth of Washington, D.C. for since I've been going there in the early 70s. And it's the same here with the state government. So let's start out with those fair information principles. There's 5 points, and this is our action-oriented in the Data Practices Act. There must be no personal data record-keeping system whose very existence is secret. In other words, you'll know, you know, is government keeping data about me through a various thing called, is it private, you get access to it. If it's confidential, you don't. Of course, if it's public, you do get access to it. There must be a way for a person to find out what information about the person is in a record and how it is used. That is very much action-oriented in our Data Practices Act, that you have a right to see all the information about you. This is one of the big principles about the body cam language last year, that that subjects of the video can look at it, not take copies of it, but can access it and review it, the raw data. They can't take a copy and give it to other people or whatever. Again, recognizing that when government makes decisions about you, you have a right. Just think, over the years, just like Mr. Elling has done, I've worked with many, many citizens. Some of the citizens, I've even worked with legislators who have asked recently to work with their constituents to get information about them when they're trying to deal with government in a licensing thing, or their kid. They want a right to be able to get an IEP plan, but the schools are saying, no, you can't. Then the parent wants to be able to get access to all the information about the kid, because the law recognizes that that information, being the guardian, the parent, or whatever, that's personal data. Another one, there must be a way for a person to prevent information about the person that's obtained for one purpose and being used for another. That is known as the Tennyson warning. Some of you may have heard of that. It says if we're going to get, you're going to collect private or confidential data about me, this is what, you know, is going to happen. Fourth, there must be a way for a person to correct or amend a record of identifiable information. That information that's about you that's being shared. And that's an element to some extent in bills that you'll see. There are elements of that in the two bills you're going to hear today about sharing of information. And if that is incorrect, that can have a huge circumstance on you in many situations. And then the last one is any organization creating, maintaining, or use has to make sure that there are no misuses. There's accountability and all those kinds of things. And that's what you all have done over the past several years with the DVS situation, where you had people looking up people, some information. I can go on and on. There's other kinds of examples that, that happen in our local and state government. So the importance that I wanted to share with you, to think about the other side of the act, other than the access for the public or whatever. But it's also important about the personal information that we, by law, are have to give for a benefit or are garnered or whatever in many different ways. And also for those people that are new and don't know anything about me, and there's an article here by Ruben Rosario. It is Meet Rich Neumeister, the People's Activist. It was done 4 years ago. It gives you a lot of insight of why I've taken 4 decades now to be involved on this issue. And it's balanced, too. I get 2 nice comments, a Republican and Democrat. And that's the way I've always been. So I just want to emphasize the importance. And I just want to say one last thing. It was kind of interesting. I made thousands of data requests over the years. And I've made one on me by different agencies. So at least I must be doing some good, because from agencies, I'm starting to see my tweets copied, my blog posts, or people saying, well, he's a, or people are saying both positive and negative and in between, whatever it might be. So it's a fun thing, and I just encourage you just to be aware of that other side of the act, about where you can get access to your own data. Thank you very much for a few moments of your time.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Any questions for Mr. Neumeister? Don't leave yet. Mr. Neumeister, I want to say to the new members that Mr. Neumeister has been around here for 4 decades, which predates, I think, everybody around this table. And he's been helpful to me in just learning how to make some data requests to find out about information about myself. And so if that's, you know, if something you're interested in doing, it's very enlightening, and he can be helpful in that area. And I think it's important that we are conscious about the information that the government holds on us and private citizens. And I thank you for your years of advocacy, and I hope members will tap into your resource of your experience. Representative Lesh, did you have something? No?
Well, I just say, Madam Chair, Mr. Neumeister, I hear you got an office now in the Capitol. Congratulations.
I used to. It was renovated for a while. Now I'll go back to the table.
So you go back into it. Okay. Well, I just want to congratulate you.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Appreciate it. All right, members, we are going to shift. Oh, Mr. Heller is in the audience and would like to have some comments. Mr. Heller, welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the tape and go ahead with your comments or questions.
Thank you, Chair. Peggy Scott and committee of the Data Practice Committee and members as well. My name is Rick Heller. I unofficially represent the twice exceptional and print disabled. The answer at the commission at the end of the, it was sometime in May, I made a public statement that if documents are not searchable, are they really transparent? Minnesota Statute 16E requires state agencies, however, the legislature has chosen to exempt themselves completely from that law. And I believe that that would be a violation of the American Disability Act, Section 508, even though you're exempt from that Minnesota Statute 16E03. A few other suggestions. As you continue to introduce bills with the XX, even though they are public in the public domain, they don't become fully accessible until they're read on the floor. 2 years ago, the Minnesota legislature decided to make the documents fully accessible for the blind, which will identify struck through or underscore underlined language. If you want to be a transparency policy, I also suggest that you create your rules that have that hold that level of competency. And as far as the few other speakers, it would be helpful that they would provide stuff in a timely manner at the same time as these meetings. That could also be in the rules, and that they provide electronically, and that the people would start to be aware of how to make stuff fully accessible, so you don't scan them in and make them in an image, because they're not searchable. The Minnesota legislature with the JAWS software, which is specialized software, upstairs in the library, again, when they provided that 2 years ago from funding for Minute. So those are my suggestions. I'd be fine to entertain any bills that might work regarding word electronic throughout the data practice Chapter 13 law. It does not define how we're going to acquire that content. And if we want to make sure that people have equity and equality or fairness and sameness, or should I say a fair play Levenfield, as I continue to data practice requests from different state agencies, and I have to have them corrected when they're sent down here. and it's a cat-and-mouse game, and it's not helpful because nobody checks the, at least it doesn't seem like no one really does a compliance check when the documents come in, that everything will be read aloud for those that are not cited. I appreciate this time to speak, and anyone has any questions, you're welcome to ask that.
Thank you, Mr. Heller. Anyone have any questions for this testifier? Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Heller, for your comments this morning. Members, we're going to move to House File 83.
Madam Chair, are we going to do a roll call before we start moving into the bills?
What do you mean?
Well, on the agenda, number two, it says roll call of members, and we haven't done a roll call.
I think.
Madam Chair, if I may, I don't care about the roll call, honestly. But I wonder if I could do this. I tried to do that before we go into the bills, because I know the bills are going to take us all the way up until the end time. And I tried to bring this up last time, but we gaveled in really quick, really fast, Madam Chair. And so I'd like to ask you a question about this. And if I could, I've got a copy that I want you to hand out. This will just take me a couple minutes. What this document shows is a breakdown of House Civil Law Committee membership from 2003 to 2017. And the reason I did this spreadsheet was because, and it's all public information, Rick, so I don't have extra copies of it, but it's all public information. It breaks down the committee membership and the majority share on this committee, and we're darn near a two-thirds majority on the committee this year, and I was wondering if there was a reason for that, because I looked at the House majority, whoever had the majority, and nowhere did we get close to a two-thirds majority, except back in 2003 under Mary Liz Holberg, and it was dead even a two-thirds majority. But other than that, there's rarely such a disproportionate share in a committee on the majority side as opposed to the minority side. Which causes me, as the minority lead, some concern. Why do you guys have so many members on your side? Was there a reason for that this year? Did it just happen? Or because it's very out of character. And just to go into briefly, you may say, well, it's because you guys got a big majority on the floor this year. And that's not true. This is by far the highest disparity in committee membership on this committee relative to floor majority, at least over the course of the past eight sessions. So it does, except for, again, 2003. But I wanted to ask you about that, if there was a reason for that, or was it just dumb luck? And if it was luck, obviously those of us in the majority notice that because we have less of a voice.
Representative Lesh, first of all, I have nothing to do with setting how many people are on each committee. That's done by leadership, so I think we'd have to take it up with them. And I believe you have six members, not five, as you've listed here.
Which
on 2017, you have okay. We have nine members, and you have five. But you actually
okay, yeah.
Have
so that's six. Off a little bit. Even with that one number off, it's very different from the previous ones. So you're still pushing very high on the majority. Numbers.
Well, that's a three-person majority, and in 2013 you had a three-person majority, and under Mullery it was 5-9, and under Mullery again it was 7-12. So,
well remember under that those years they were dead even with the majority on the floor, so it measured up the disparity between the floor majority and the majority in this committee was zero. And I know the majority is always going to stack committees a little bit. That's what you got to do. You've got fewer numbers. However, this year is just different. And I know that they probably didn't consult you when they said how many members are you going to have on. But I just noticed when we did this committee this year, it's just very different, Madam Chair. So I wanted to bring that up and let you know that it didn't go without notice in the minority.
Thank you. Okay, members, on to House File 83. And I'm going to move House File 83 before the committee and recommend that it be referred to Commerce and Regulatory Reform, the Regulatory Reform Committee. I do have some amendments. There's an A3. And members, let me just give a brief explanation about what this bill is doing and why it's here in our committee. And then I'm going to have House Research go over the parts of the bill and the amendment that apply to our committee, and we're going to only be taking up those sections today. As you know, House File 1 that was introduced last week was an attempt to help solve this health care crisis that we have, with premiums being unaffordable to many, many Minnesotans. And so one of the plans in House File 1 is to have MMB help facilitate any rebates or any help that Minnesotans would get in paying their health care premiums. And so in order to make that happen, there's certain data that MMB is going to have from the health care plans so that they know, can verify, first of all, eligibility, that people do indeed, they can verify their, first of all, that they're Minnesota citizens, and secondly, that they're eligible income-wise to qualify for any premium assistance. And so that's what this data bill is trying to do, is to try to protect that data of the people that will be having to fill out an application to get that premium assistance. And one of the things in this bill, this amendment and bill does, is it gives a Tennyson warning to those people, so when they're filling out the application, they understand fully that their data is going to have to be shared in order to get the premium assistance. Also in House File 1, I don't think it's explicitly written in 83, but this will be going to conference committee, is the fact that the legislative auditor is going to be doing an audit after this program has reached its conclusion, to make sure that everything was done right and that data was shared securely. So with that, I will have House Research go through the provisions of the bill and the amendment.
Madam Chair and members, on HF 83, Section 1 of the bill requires the Commissioner of Commerce to provide public access to compiled data for proposed rate changes by health plans. And that data would have to be public within 10 days of the proposed rates being filed with the commissioner. Under current law, that sort of data is non-public until the filing becomes effective. Section 2 of the bill deals with transition of care and what sorts of things a enrollee's health plan can require the enrollee to submit when applying for transition of care coverage. Section 3 of the bill also deals with data issues. Subdivision 1 of Section 3 deals with verification of residency. It permits the commissioner of MMB to access data from the Department of Employment and Economic Development and the Department of Revenue to verify that people applying for premium assistance for health insurance are in fact Minnesota residents. And Subdivision 2 deals with the recovery of improper payments to people who should not have received them. Moving on to the A03 amendment. As Representative Scott stated, the A03 amendment contains language from House File 1. The definitions are pulled directly from House File 1. The proposed addition, Section 5, premium assistance amount. Subdivision 1 of this section concerns how individuals would apply to the commissioner, this is the commissioner of MMB, to receive premium assistance. Among other things, the amendment states that the application for premium assistance that the individual fills out and submits to the commissioner of MMB must include a Tennyson warning, and that's a difference from the language that's currently in HF1. So this amendment adds that Tennyson warning to the application. Moving on to subdivision 2, a key difference between this amendment and HF1 is that it includes an end date on data sharing from health plan companies to the commissioner of MMB. So subdivision 2 generally refers to the data that the healthcare companies will submit to MMB regarding enrollees under their specific health plan. The difference between HF1 and this amendment is that through June 30, 2018 language. So that provides an end date for a date when health plans will stop sharing data with the commissioner. This is also different from HF1 in the sense that HF1 contains a subparagraph 5 there under subdivision 2A. There was a 5 which stated that the commissioner was also able to request from health plans any additional information the commissioner determined appropriate to administer the program. This amendment's different from HF1 in the sense that that provision, that subparagraph, has been removed in this amendment. The most important addition with regard to data practices in this amendment, and this is all language which is not in HF1, is subdivision 5. They're on lines 3.25 to 3.29. This subdivision states that information that a health plan company provides to the commissioner under subparagraph 2 is private data on individuals, so that data would not be public. And subparagraph B states that notwithstanding the commissioner of MMB's retention schedule, the commissioner has to destroy any data received under subparagraph 2 on June 30th, 2018. As Chair Scott stated, the Office of Legislative Auditor is required to do an audit and submit a report on this program. That report is required by June 1st, 2018. So the idea of subparagraph B there in subdivision 5 is that the commissioner would destroy the data received from the health plans after that OLA audit had been completed.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just as soon as you finish with your presentation, I'm hoping that the commissioner can testify. This bill is being heard in civil law and HHS both this morning at 8:15, as well as in the Commerce Committee at 10:30. And if we could get the commissioner up to allow him to testify, and then so he can move on to his next committee as well, that would be helpful.
Commissioner of Commerce is here. You're
no, the,
Representative Hillstrom.
I'm sorry.
MMB.
Commissioner of MMB.
Okay. Thank you. Members, I do have a couple of oral amendments to this amendment. The first one of those was recommended by the Department of Administration, and the language change, I believe that staff has this change, this oral amendment. If you want to go through that first oral amendment, that would be helpful to the members. Thank you.
Madam Chair and members, the oral amendments to the AO3 amendments at page 3, line 25, delete that a health plan company provides and insert provided. Page 3, line 26, delete subdivision 2 and insert subdivisions 1 and 2.
Repeat that again, please.
Page 3, line 26, delete subdivision 2 and insert subdivisions 1 and 2.
Representative Lesh.
So, question is to that oral amendment. Obviously, that means there's other people providing data or information other than health plan companies. So who else is providing, or who do we want to let provide it now and have that data be private other than a health plan company?
Go ahead, Ms. Mullen.
Chair and members, in subdivision 1, the data can be provided by an eligible individual. because the individual is filling out an application. So in theory, you could have not just health plans, but individuals and people who are assisting individuals in filling out the application. So I think they wanted to broaden it.
Okay, thank you.
Right. It's the information coming from the applicant and also from the health plan companies, as I understand it. So any questions on those oral amendments or on the amendment before us, the A03? Seeing none, Representative Lesh.
Yeah, I will confess. I don't know if anyone else around the table is going to admit it, but I don't get this. I really don't know what we're doing. I know that we've got data coming from health plan companies, and maybe this goes to the I'll just leave this for now, since it is the majority's job to pass this bill, and hopefully every member of the majority gets this, and I guarantee you they don't. What was the fundamental need? Was this cleanup language all for House File 83, Madam Chair, or what was the primary reason why you offered this?
Mr. Election Committee members, I want to make sure that the data provisions are as tight as they can be in this given situation.
Okay, well, that was a general answer, but you've got more language in your amendment than is in House File 83. So it substantially changes the bill, and I'll just confess that I am not tracking all the. There appear to be a lot of changes in here, and a lot of qualifications. Now, did Madam Chair and Representative Hillstrom, did you say that the MMB Commissioner was going to be down testifying specifically with respect to this A03 amendment?
Representative Hillstrom, thank you. I believe he is going to come and talk about that data. I had some conversations with him that we would be talking about data. But it's my understanding that the data that is collected from the plan, in order to administer this plan, the consumer would apply. There'd have to be verification that they actually had insurance, so there would be information coming from the insurance. There then would have to be income verification, which would mean that the federal government and the tax information would be coming. Then there'd be a residency verification, so information about whether or not they live in the state of Minnesota would be verified, and so that data would come in. And then there would be an evaluation on criteria on whether or not they are eligible in the past. So I really would like him to talk about the pieces, because this is a lot of data sharing with a lot of databases, and this committee usually doesn't let a lot of people collect this much information about someone.
Maybe would it be okay if we heard from MMB before we voted on the? I know normally it's the protocol where the author gets the bill in the shape that you want before we move on it, but could we hear from the testifier before we vote on the amendment? It's just, that's a big amendment.
Sure, I'll allow that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Mr. Commissioner. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Myron Franz, Commissioner of Minnesota Management and Budget. Thank you so much for being flexible to allow me to jump in here in your process. One of the things that we wanted to do in talking about data practices, the first thing I wanted to get is, I'm not a data practices expert, you folks are, but what I want to talk a little bit about is the concerns, and Representative Hillstrom described in some context kind of what's happening here and our concern about the huge amount of data that's going to be collected and shared. But I want to offer my first recommendation to solve almost all of your data practices issues. Do not collect the data. We do not need to collect the data. Under the governor's proposal, the rebate is provided on the insurance invoice. So if you're James Smith, you get an invoice from the insurance plan in March, you owe $1,000, you would get 25% rebate, so you would pay $750, and that is it. And so what happens after that is the MMB would reimburse the plans for those payments. Now, Commerce, we would ask Commerce or whoever, Office of Legislative Auditors, fine. We would ask someone to come in afterward for $700,000, maybe $300,000, or do an audit, spot check, and make sure those people were the same people who qualify. The key is that when you're buying insurance on the invoice, there's no check from the government going out to somebody. And so therefore, we don't have the same fraud concerns that we do under a normal refund check. So, but let me just real quickly walk through the data points that Representative Hillstrom admitted were a problem. First, the web application process, which is totally unnecessary. But let's assume we set this program up. We have a web application process. You want to get your refund. You send us an application. We have to set up an application system for people we don't normally do business with. These are not our employees. These are not people that are in our data set. So we have to set up a data system to accept their date of birth, their family information, a lot of personal data that we don't want anyone to get a hold of. So we get that information in, and then we need to go back to the plans and say, would you verify that we just got this application from James Smith, and would you verify that actually is James Smith, he actually paid you the insurance, and this is the level of insurance that he bought. So we have to marry up those transactions, have to talk to one another. Then we have to take that data set, and we have to go to either deed or revenue and verify that they're a resident. And that exchange has to occur. Then we have to go to figure out how to go to the federal tax system. Right now, the only way to do the income test is to somehow connect with the federal tax data system, because they're the ones that have the tax data on these information. So we have to, first of all, wait till they file their income tax returns for 2016, and then we go there, and we'd have to, right now, Minsure has a process that interfaces with the federal hub where this information is located, but we would have to design our own. The Minsure portal, if you will, to that data is designed under the Affordable Care Act rules. We'd have to design one under these rules, share that information with them, and go back and forth on a basis. So then we would also, we'd have to make sure that we set up an audit trail so that after the fact, the revenue department, I think, is listed with going and doing an audit of this. We'd have to make sure that we kept the data in such a form that the revenue department could go back and audit that data. Now, remember, we'd have to get all this done before the data is destroyed in 2018 at some point. So anyway, that's the problem. That's why we think it's going to take so long to set this up. We have to develop all these components to talk with one another in a secure fashion that allows this to occur on a monthly basis. And then, remember, the rules in the who qualifies for what level of percentage changes over time. So we have to set up a rule system so this calculation occurs every time. We think that each application would require about 2 hours of human time over the course of the next 6 months or a year. Well, that's 200,000 hours. That's 100 people to do that. And that's just during the application process. So anyway, I would urge you not to do this bill in the way that it is, and not get into all this data collection, and not worry about protecting it, because we do not need it to get premium relief to individuals soon. So I'm happy to take questions.
Mr. Franz, or Commissioner Franz, I appreciate you being here. What does the governor's proposal do to verify eligibility?
Well, the first thing, Madam Chair, the first thing it does is it provides premium relief to those people who are actually buying insurance from an insurance plan. So the nature of the initial transaction, the invoice between the insurance plan and the consumer, makes it difficult to imagine fraud. The worst thing that can happen is someone can get cheaper insurance. They're not going to get a check. They're not going to get cash. They're just going to get insurance for a lower amount. So the verification process is that the insurance plans are selling to people who are buying insurance. Then what we would do after the fact is Commerce would come in and check that on a periodic basis to make sure that those lined up with that the people that qualified for that rebate didn't also get the federal tax credit. We want to make sure that doesn't happen. But that's the primary concern we have. But we would audit and make sure that there's a verified plan.
So Mr. Franz, I appreciate that. A couple of things before I get to some member questions. You say that Minsure is already set up to handle this information with the National Hub. Our experience since the inception of Minsure is that it's been a very, very flawed system. And so we don't, excuse us, but we don't have a high level of comfort in allowing Minsure to handle this, nor the Department of Commerce, who knew about these rate increases far ahead of the general public. And so instead of making that public, and they knew this information, and so did the governor's office, before legislative session was out last year, we could have taken up the problem that the Commerce Department knew that existed but kept that information secret. And then instead we have people being asked to pay $3,300 a month for their health insurance premium. So forgive us if we don't think that the Department of Commerce and Minsure are capable of doing it the governor's way. Representative Looney.
Thank you, Madam Chairman, and Mr. Franz, thank you for appearing today. The eventually there would have to be a when you talk about this, this would only be dealing with people who purchase insurance. I'm assuming the state of Minnesota has to go through some verification process with the carriers that in fact all of the people that we are sending funds over for actually have insurance through the plan.
Mr. Franz, or Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair and Representative, obviously, I mean, the plans are not going to, they're not going to provide the rebate until someone purchases insurance. So when someone pays an invoice and they accept the rebate and they pay the premium, they're getting insurance. They are covered. Now, if they go off the plan and they don't pay any more, then they're not going to get any rebate because they're not paying any premium. So it's the payment of the premium that keeps them locked in to this relationship. Obviously, we want to make sure that that continues and there's no doubling up or unusual names. But remember, the worst case scenario is that someone's buying insurance that's cheaper than it would have been otherwise. The other thing, though, that I want to really point out is that, and the reason we think it's going to take so long to implement House File 1 with respect to your comments, Madam Chair, is that if you implement an IT project on a political timeline, you're destined for problems. And that's one of the reasons that Minsure had the problems it did. We tried to implement an IT project on a political deadline, on a political schedule that simply didn't work. That's why it's going to take, we think, until 2018 before we can set up the system required by House File 1. If you want us to do it, we're going to do it right, and it's going to be done in a way that protects data and make sure that we can follow this up. So the nature of that relationship between the insurers and the plans frankly provides that initial verification, which we would follow up with the verification from Commerce.
Representative Lunin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The governor's plan, what is the proposed timeline as far as when that would be enacted? I was one of the legislators that met with the health plans, and they stated in that meeting that regardless of how this panned out, that they're probably looking at the end of 2017 for any type of movement on this.
Madam Chair, Representative, they've told us anywhere from 2 to 3 months they can make this operational on their invoice system, depending upon when it's passed during the month. If you wait till the 15th, by the way, it's another deadline we have, January 15th, we probably lose another month. But 2 to 3 months, and they can have it operational on the invoice.
Thank you.
Okay, Representative Lesh.
I forgot my question, Madam Chair.
Any other? All right, thank you. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner. I know this is the Data Practices Committee, and it's not a budget committee, but I notice in the bill, you just stated that that it would take you about 100 employees to implement the language as they have it here. In the overall bill, is there an amount of money to pay for the system, or is that something that is supposed to be eaten by the department? Otherwise, if it's eaten by the department, will it cut into the amount of rebate that actually goes out to the people? And then what's the timeline for people to actually see the money under the, we heard from the about the governor's plan, but what about under the bill that we have before?
Commissioner Franz.
Madam Chair, Representative, our best guess at this point, we've been working on this since over the weekend and the last few days to come up with what we think are the component parts. But our concern is that the bill provides, I think, $8.5 million for administrative costs. We don't think that comes anywhere close. We believe that we would want to first of all start with a request for a proposal to find out who in the private industry is already doing these kinds of things and what systems could we purchase that would speed this thing up a little bit. But nonetheless, an RFP process is anywhere from 4 to 6 months on it on its own, and then it would take several months for that to get up and running. So that's why we don't believe we can get actual checks to people until the beginning of 2018. We think it could cost at least $20 million to do this process by going through an RFP, by bringing on these different processes. But the 200 people that I mentioned, that's just for the application process. That's just to have people on board to receive the application, review the application, make sure all the information there is there. Remember, these things never run as smoothly as you think they will. And then they'd have to also process if they found out information about the residency or the income limit that might restrict them. We'd have to talk to those people and say that they're not going to get it. So the 200 people was just for the application process itself.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my concern is even the speaker said that this was an emergency and that we needed to deal with it right away, and we thought we were going to have a special session, and we didn't. So my question is,
the timeline then for someone to actually get relief, you are pushing out till 2018. So what happens if folks can't pay the premium between 2017, when this new proposal would go into effect and the checks would actually go out, versus, you know, people can't pay the premiums right now today?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think the real concern we have, and why we were advocating for the governor's plan to do a more immediate relief package, was we believe people are out there waiting now, that there are folks waiting to decide whether they can afford to buy insurance or not right now, today. I mean, people are already paying the January premiums, so, or for February now. So these folks are out there trying to decide, do I sign up by January 31st? Can I afford it? And if we don't implement this plan now, there are a lot of people who cannot carry this load for the entire year. There are some folks who are going to need to have that premium relief occur very quickly, or they're not going to be afford to wait until the end of 2017 to get that relief. We talked about it this fall in October and November, and we talked to a number of different members about whether we should do a tax credit as a way to get relief to folks. The problem with tax credit is you don't get relief to people until 2018. Same thing is now is true with setting up this application and refund process, is that we can't get relief to people until 2018. So that we're concerned about the market. We want as many people that can afford to buy insurance, know that they're getting relief, know that it's coming in several months. One of the things we'll do, if we implement the governor's program, we would require that the first invoice that this refund is operational, they would give credit for the prior month's invoices. So that 25% over January, February, March, whatever, would get credit on that first invoice. So they'd get caught up. They only have to cash flow, if you will, until March or April, when we can get the system in place. Otherwise, they've got to carry it for the entire year.
Thank you. Representative Lesh, please keep your questions to the data portions that we're discussing here today, because we need to take a vote here. There's another committee coming in after ours.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would note, I won't note that. But, Madam Chair and Commissioner Franz, I think I get it now, and your clarifications were enlightening. So it sounds to me like the bill, and even though it's not the data section, Madam Chair, the $8.5 million is supposedly pays for this, according to you guys, and according to Commissioner Franz, doesn't come anywhere close. So that is relevant. So my question is, Commissioner Franz, is this a situation where the bill creates a system in order to make sure people who shouldn't get the rebate don't get it, and creating that system costs more than what it would cost to fund the rebate, essentially? You know, whether it's $8.5 million or $20 million or whatever it is it costs. That's my concern. Are we doing the classic, creating so much government that we don't even know what we're doing?
Representative Lesh, this isn't the committee to take up the cost.
Well, Madam Chair, with all due respect, absolutely it is. You have
no, it's not. We're not a finance committee.
You're asking us to pass language that creates all these classifications and explodes government. I thought the GOP didn't like bigger government. You're creating a gigantic system that we're going to be accountable to our constituents for paying for. Whether you're saying we don't have to talk about costs now, this is just the data practices. You're creating a huge system that's going to be impossible to administer. So this is absolutely the place to talk
this
about
this. This bill is going to go to conference committee, and a lot of these details are going to be hashed out there.
Madam Chair, that's the same thing that Representative Hoppe said on the floor last week. Don't worry about it now. It'll get worked out in conference committee. I'm accountable to my constituents when I'm voting on a bill in committee to supposedly know what's in the bill and then also be responsible for what it actually does. And creating these data sets is exploding government to a level that, like I said, I didn't think you guys originally liked, but apparently you like now. And my question to Commissioner Franz is this so expensive that it's actually a waste of our time, potentially?
Madam Chair, Representative, that is exactly the question we asked ourselves last October and November. We thought about the same idea about having an income test, but we realized it could not be implemented in a way in 2017 that would actually allow us to get checks, refund checks to people in 2017. So the cost to implement the income test outweighs the benefit in our view.
Well, Madam Chair,
I'm going to call a vote on the amendments, because we have to get out of here for another committee. All those in favor of the AO3 as amended orally, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion carries. The bill is before us. All those in favor of passage of House File 83 as amended, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign.
No.
No.
The motion prevails. House File 83 is on its way to Commerce. We will reconvene the Committee on Civil Law Data Practices. We are here tonight to hear the Real ID bill. Representative Smith will be presenting that. Just to let folks know, there were two amendments that were submitted. They didn't meet the 24-hour rule. And I have copies of those amendments here if members want to see them. One was submitted by Representative Dean, the other by Representative Nash. And out of fairness to both, since neither one of them met the deadline, you're welcome to offer those at the next committee stop or on the floor, but neither one of them met the 24-hour rule.
Madam Chair?
Representative Dean.
At some point, I'd like to offer mine as an oral amendment then.
Well, Madam Chair?
Representative Lesh.
So was that 24 hours from when we were supposed to meet or 24 hours from now?
Representative Lesh, it's 24 hours from when we were this morning.
Well, it's 5 o'clock now. I mean, can't you? There's been under, I guess, the interpretation of your rule, you could say that you should be able to allow those, right? People have had enough time to review them.
I don't know that they were. I don't think they were posted online, were they? They weren't posted online for the public to see because they didn't meet the rule this morning. So. This is going to transportation next. I think it could be offered there. But that's we didn't have it in time when we were planning the committee. So, Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I want to speak about the hearing that we had and the bill that this committee passed out this morning. So, members, Rule 6.22 of the Minnesota House of Representatives rules, it's Article 6, Committees and Reports. The rule states that public testimony from proponents and opponents must be allowed on every bill or resolution before a standing committee, division, or subcommittee of the House. Members, I believe that when the committee bill passed out this morning that it was directly in violation of House Rule 6.22. And, Madam Chair, I would hope that you, as the chair, would reconsidering that vote or at least allowing for public testimony on that proposal to come in compliance with House Rule 6.22. Otherwise, I would hope that should a motion come to re-refer it back to committee for violation of that House rule, that this committee would agree that proponents and opponents of this morning's hearing did not have the opportunity to testify. You could spend some time between now and Wednesday's House floor listening to that, but I think you'll all find that that bill passed out of this committee in violation of the Minnesota House rules, and I think that that should not happen. I think that there were people in this committee room that wanted to testify on that proposal. I understand that we were short on time due to the weather. I just don't think that that waives the House rules, and I think this committee should comply with those.
There was testimony on the bill. Representative Lash, question?
Yeah, Madam Chair, first of all, there was pretty much no testimony on that bill. That bill just blew through here, and for the entire scope of that bill, for us to put that through, that what we did this morning doesn't happen that often around here on a bill that's that controversial. But the other thing I wanted to point out is that these bleachers were full this morning on this bill that we're going to hear now, Representative Smith's bill. And there are a lot of people that are not here right now that were here this morning prepared to be heard on Representative Smith's bill. And I think that's a tragedy that people drove in from across Minnesota and now can't be heard. They were here this morning because it was noticed on time and on the agenda. And I really hope that's not how we do business in the future, because there's a lot of faces I saw this morning that I know wanted to be heard on this bill that are not here today.
Thank you, Representative Lesh. Representative Smith, would you like to move your bill?
I would, Madam Chair. So moved.
Go ahead and present your bill, please.
Madam Chair, members, House File 3 is the Real ID bill that's going to allow the Department of Public Safety to implement a license option, an opt-in option for residents of Minnesota who would like to be compliant with the federal ID standard. This bill is similar to the bill introduced and discussed on the House floor in 2016. This is a two-tier system. For those who want to opt in and have a Real ID compliant license, they can. For those who wish to not be a part of the Real ID system, they have that option as well. The implementation date is changed in this bill to start January 1st, 2018. DPS has made a commitment that they can make that date. So Real ID compliant licenses will be issued January 1st, 2018. Also, the cost of this is $60,000 over the biennium, $30,000 each year for programming fees. Specifically, Madam Chair and members, I'd like to point out four sections that are relevant to this committee of this bill. Specifically, Section 5, Conformity of Real ID Limitations. There's some definitions in this section, as well as the establishment of a two-tier system. Subsection 3 deals with the compliance of Real ID as limited to the requirements of the effective date of the law is implemented. Commissioner may not take any action to implement or meet requirements of a federal change after said effective date. And subsection 4, when the commissioner learns of a federal change, the commissioner must notify the chairs and the ranking minority members of the legislative committees having jurisdiction over transportation policy, transportation finance, public safety, data practices and civil law, and legislative commission on data privacy. The second section I'd like to highlight, Madam Chair, is Section 17. Section 17 deals with an audit trail for the individuals that are authorized by law to deal with this data. It deals with penalties for noncompliance and some specifics, details about a proper audit. The third section, Madam Chair and members, is Section 18. Deals with the applicants that they, if they choose not to give a copy of their birth certificate to the DPS, deals with the specifics of that. They can allow DPS to keep a copy or they may not. And the last section, Madam Chair and members, is Section 19, the data privacy for noncompliant licenses. The Commissioner of DPS may not disseminate any data outside the state of Minnesota that is currently not being shared at the time this law is of its effective date. With that, Madam Chair, I'll ask stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative Stanton. The plan is to, I know that we have Ms. Don Olson here, is the Director of DVS, and so she's the first testifier we have on our list. And since she's from the department, I will give her the time that she needs. Then the plan with the remainder of the testifiers is to limit testimony to 2 to 3 minutes. And I have staff here that has a sign that will let people know when their time is up so that we all can get home to your families. It's been a long day. So, Ms. Olson, did you come prepared to testify? Is that all right with you, Representative Smith, if she testifies and then we take questions after that?
Madam Chair, yes.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record. Thanks for joining us this evening.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Don Olson. I'm the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services at the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for the opportunity to provide information on House File 3 relating to the requirements of the Federal Real ID Act. I'd like to provide some additional information about the bill that is based on our review. I'd like to start out talking about the implementation date. To clarify, last year the department did speak to the January timeline as far as implementation and issuing of the Real ID. However, things have grown and new things have come up in this past year that I'd like to talk about a little bit more in detail and explain a little bit more about what that timeline means. The bill implementation deadline is not possible for us to meet. As of now, the enforcement date of Real ID to be compliant is October 1, 2020. This bill indicates the ability to issue Real ID compliant cards by January 1 of 2018. There are a number of pieces that need to come together over this next year before the Real ID card can be issued. First off, this will require significant training for driver's license agents because Real ID requires original ID documents, proof of address information, and proof of Social Security. They will need time to learn all these documents as well as other necessary requirements. In addition, DLA agents are working as vehicle deputy registrar staff and are just in the beginning of stages of adjusting to the new MNLARS information system. MNLARS will be ready this spring, and this will create additional stress on these offices as they have to learn how to work with both systems. Real ID also requires fingerprinting and background checks for DL agents. This will take time to get this completed. And last, we will be bringing a new card vendor on to be able to produce new cards in the next few weeks. The time that is needed for this vendor to plan for these requirements is additional work that needs to be done, not only for the new ID for Minnesota drivers, but for the Real ID requirements. The requirement in House Filing 3 to mail information is expensive as it moves from a postcard to a need for envelopes. In addition, based on our experience with the recently enacted insurance verification, which also includes information on the renewal notice, inserts or written material are ineffective because people simply don't read them. The department believes that using our website, providing the URL to the website on the renewal postcard, and having staff work with customers when they come in will be much more effective and less problematic. We agree of the need for education, and the department is discussing other education strategies, including providing additional information at renewal locations, as we agree that this is critical to the success of this program. In addition, the bill does not require proof of name change as a requirement for Real ID applicants. Proof of name change is necessary for Real ID compliance, so we can issue cards in the person's correct legal name. The bill only allows ID documents to be used as proof of lawful status. However, other documents can be issued by DHS and are used as proof of lawful status. These documents can be verified through SAVE once we have applied for this interface. The use of the SAVE interface is a requirement for Real ID compliance. This bill prohibits the use of a variance by those with temporary lawful status. Real ID cares about immigration status, and in some cases, other document types are needed to add as additional verification for us to identify individuals. So we do need the verification process to work with those individuals as they are making application. House File 13 also requires proof of Social Security numbers on all applications. We currently do not require proof of a Social Security card on non-applicants, so the provision could negatively impact those who are applying for non-compliant cards. The department estimates the loss of revenue to be higher than what was proposed in the bill and would welcome an opportunity to meet with the bill's author to explain the difference with regard to providing free ID cards to applicants. Real ID requires us to verify if the applicant has more than one ID card in another jurisdiction. Without the ability to verify non-compliant card applicants, our non-compliant card will become fraud-prone and minimize the card security. We need to make our best effort by ensuring all card applicants hold only one credential. House File 3 requires all compliant cards to have the Real ID indicator. However, EDL cards are compliant cards, and this does not require a Real ID indicator on the card. We will need additional statutory language allowing non-compliant cardholders to be grandfathered into the not-for-federal identification indicator that is required to be placed on the card. This would allow non-compliant cardholders to remain valid until their next renewal period. And lastly, House File 3 requires additional security and auditing procedures to ensure compliance. The MNLARS information system will have role-based privileges to ensure only those needing to view specific data for their jobs will have access to this information. MNLARS will track all user activity in the system. In addition, our current data use vendors provide us with annual auditing reports to demonstrate their compliance on how they use our information. If we are required to arrange for an independent biannual audit, we will reflect this cost in our fiscal note. And with that, I'm prepared for questions.
Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olson, two questions for you. Number one, well, actually three questions because the first one is two-part. So when's the new deadline, 2020 sometime?
Ms. Olson. Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, the Real ID compliance deadline is October 1st, 2020.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Olson. How many deadlines have we passed so far? At last count on the floor last year, we were at seven. Seven times where the federal government said, you better or else, and then we skipped it. So are we at eight or nine or ten now? Do you know what number we're at?
Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I do not.
Okay.
Representative Lesh?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And my second question relates to line 6.25 in the bill, which is the language that I think a lot of people are here about today. Is this language required state language for compliance with the Federal Real ID Act?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, you're talking about lawful status, is that correct? As defined by Code of Federal Regs? As far as I know, yes.
Okay. Madam Chair,
Representative Lesh.
Two things I guess I would just note. There are going to be other testifiers that come in and testify on all this, but first, normally, when you get told you got to do this or else a bunch of times, eventually you lose faith in the threats. But for some reason in Minnesota, we've started believing them more. And I don't know why that is, especially when you guys, the Republicans, are bringing this bill, and normally you can't run far enough away from federal regulations. And on the two bills we've had in this committee today, you're just lining up at the federal government trough to see how much you can lap up on what they tell us we have to do. And considering the fact that we've skipped over all these deadlines, and some people in this committee, well, I know you, Madam Chair, and a few other people, voted against this in 2009 when Governor Pelini said, no way are we gonna do this. The about face to me is stunning, especially when brought by the Republicans. But second, the fact that you've added on this, the piece on the lawful status. You know, the GOP really has to get this thing figured out between the anti-immigrant and the pro-business wings of the party, because we can see you guys airing out your dirty laundry, and it's not pretty. Sooner or later, your business donors are going to have to explain to you that this doesn't work out. My great-grandparents were unlawful immigrants, and I bet most of yours were too. Mine were Irish that came over from Canada, and you know what? There's no border at that time. They just wandered in, okay? So the fact that now we're pulling the rope ladder up after us when we get up in the tree is disingenuous, aside from being bad for a lot of business interests. So I'll leave it at that, and Madam Chair, I may have some other comments when the other testifiers come speak to it. Thank you.
Other member questions? Representative Carlson.
Just in my quick notes, based on your presentation, just wanted to seek some follow-up information. You mentioned that currently the proof of name change is has to be required. Can you speak to that a little bit further?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, from our review of the bill, it does not call that out, and we need to have that specified, that with a name change, we do have to provide proof. Even if the name changed over a number of times, we need to see the chain of events.
Seems like a common sense kind of request. And then,
Representative Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This particular bill calls for proof of Social Security, whereas currently that's not required. Is that correct in terms of how I have that stated here?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, yes, that is correct. Our current process for a non-compliant card is to attest to your Social Security number. Whereas with the Real ID, you have to show proof. of your Social Security number.
And then lastly,
Representative Carlson.
Thank you. Lastly, if you could speak to some of the numbers in terms of lost revenue, mentioning that they would be considerably higher than what were stated in the bill. Could you provide some context to that?
Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I called it out and as more of an indicator. When if the law changes and there's a period of time where non-compliant holders do not have the option for a real ID card because we're not issuing it yet, and once we do become, or if we do become real ID compliant, they choose to come in and want to get a real ID card, the bill says we will offer that to them at no cost. That's where our numbers show a little bit different as to probably the volume of people that would come in versus what the numbers were quoted in the bill. And so we would just like to have a little bit more clarification around how those numbers were determined and what we think could probably be the numbers that would come in and ask for a real ID compliant card.
Yeah, I think we would all,
Representative Carlson,
benefit from that information. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Dean, I'm so sorry.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I actually have a few questions. And one of them, the first one, let me start. You know, you had talked about the URL and having people do things online. And I'm certain that that will expedite, you know, the process for many people. But we still have many pockets of the state that don't have access to really, you know, the type of broadband that they would need to do this. So can you speak to any idea how many people might not be able to use this out in rural Minnesota where we don't have broadband?
Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I don't have quantifiable numbers or estimations that I could provide. It's more of the experience that we've had, and our most recent is around the insurance verification. Mm-hmm. Requiring people to bring their insurance information in. Our experience has been very few people are paying attention to that on the renewal notice, and it's causing people to have to maybe make a call home, you know, do some backpedaling to try to find this information. The reason we're a little concerned about drafting written correspondence is because this is going to be complicated for people to understand. And the criteria for what each identification card means. We felt it would be best if we could take more of a multi-attempt at this. For some people, written information will work. For other people, getting the information online will work. For others, having somebody there that they can meet with and talk to and understand the differences will work. So our intention was really to allow us to look at what's the best mechanism and what are the strategies we could come up with to best serve this population, knowing that multiple people are going to have multiple different needs. And so to limit ourselves to mailing out is an expensive proposition. It doesn't always necessarily give you the kind of results that you would expect. Not that we couldn't do it. We can. But we also might have to look at multiple approaches to be able to educate people on what the licenses mean.
Great. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Olson. So prior to 2001, did we require people to make a verification of their status for a driver's license?
Ms. Olson.
No. Madam Chair and members, no, we did not.
You did not. Okay. And the state didn't. So that was a change that took place in 2001. And Madam Chair, and I would assume that it was a result of 9/11 and Homeland Security, that we changed our laws in the state to put that forward as some type of a protection from individuals and threats to our state.
Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair and members of the committee, I can't speak directly to 2001. I know the requirements for real ID are a result of 9/11 and the 9/11 Commission. So I would have to get back to you on an answer to what happened at 2001.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Ms. Olson. And Madam Chair, one last question. So if we have the two-tiered system and they're both requiring a status, verification of status, would it be much easier, and I'm assuming it would be easier, if the non-compliant didn't require a verification of status? Because since it's non-compliant, it doesn't follow under the real ID requirements.
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, I'm not as familiar with what happened in 2001 and the non-compliant piece, so let me come back to you with more specific information on that.
Yeah. Well, Madam Chair, it was stated that, the verification of status of non-compliant is something that is going to require, a lot of documentation for that to take place, and if we went back for the non-compliant to where we were in the year 2000, that would probably make issuing of non-compliant driver's license for those individuals who choose not to participate in the government program with the Real ID, it would make, I would assume, it would be a much easier process for the department.
Ms. Olson?
Madam Chair and members, the issue around verifying on the non-compliance is really targeted at making sure that applicants only have one identification document. It has nothing to do with the lawful status. Right now, we don't participate in those programs to be able to verify. If an individual comes into the state of Minnesota, claims they have no other identification, we take their word at that. We want to be able to have the availability, as well as Real ID requires, that we do our best effort to ensure that that individual only has one identification card. So that was my intention around the non-compliant piece, is that it doesn't allow us to do that for non-compliant, only for the compliant, the Real ID cards. And our recommendation is we do it for all applicants because of the security and the fraud potential without verifying that information.
Representative Dean, you're good. Just one comment before I get to Representative Hillstrom's question. We're not the first state to do the dual track. And so are you working with other states that have gone through this process before to see what worked for them? If you could answer that question.
Madam Chair and members, yes, there's a lot of documentation that exists from experiences that other states have had. We certainly have our border states that have gone through this experience, so we have Midwestern experience for people that are close by, and so the information and the research is certainly there to help guide us through this.
Great. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So I have a question regarding line 15.18 about the tribal identification card. Previously, Minnesota has deemed a tribal ID card acceptable, and now you're adding a section, a line on 15.22 saying it only applies to non-compliant license and identifications cards. And then it also goes on to line 16.3 and 16.4 to clarify that. Now, is that a requirement of the federal government, or is there a reason why specifically we are making a change to Minnesota's policy surrounding tribal ID?
And Representative Hillstrom, is that for Ms. Olson or for the author?
Ms. Olson, if she can answer it, and if she can't, the author.
All right. Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the reason the tribal ID card is called out is because of the Real ID requirements. A tribal ID card does not meet the Real ID requirements for documentation. It will for non-compliant, but it will not for Real ID compliant.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And then if you could clarify, in Minnesota, we allow people to put a lot of things on their driver's license, right? If they want to be a donor, if they've got specific hunting training, we allow people to put a lot of items on their driver's license. If we do this dual track system and adopt the Real ID proposal that's in this bill, will all of the things that people document now on their license be available to be put on the Real ID, or will they have to opt out of the Real ID in order to keep what they currently have on their license?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, there would be no change to that. The only change would be the Real ID card has to have an indicator on it to indicate that it is a Real ID compliant card. So that doesn't change any of the other indicators that are on a card. They don't have to make that determination. So in some states, they've chosen to put a star. Other states have a flag. Whatever the indicator is that we get approval to put on, that's the indicator that will indicate that this is a Real ID document. So it will change nothing else on the card.
Representative Hillstrom? Ms. Olson, I know you mentioned that you're going to be meeting, or you've got a new card vendor. Mm-hmm. Is that a card vendor that is
previously implemented, gone through this Real ID process?
Madam Chair, yes, it is.
Representative Carlson, did I see a hand again?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Olson, can you spend some time talking about the radio frequency identification chip that's going to be, what information will be stored on that chip, who can access it, how it will be used, if you can kind of walk us through the significance of that? Because that's a critical piece to this, correct?
Ms. Olson.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, the chip is not part of the Real ID.
It's not.
It's not. A chip is part of an enhanced driver's license. So there would not be a chip in a Real ID card.
Representative Carlson, as I understand it, it's just going to have the magnetic strip, and on the magnetic strip is going to contain the same information that's on the front of the card in that strip.
That's correct.
Is that correct?
That's correct.
Other questions from members? All right, we will move ahead with testimony. Thank you, Ms. Olson. Bentley Graves is the first or the next testifier. On deck is Mitch Killian with MAC. Mr. Graves, welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape and go ahead with your testimony, and we have our timekeeper going here.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Bentley Graves. I'm the Director of Transportation and Healthcare Policy at the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. And just for kind of level setting, the Chamber has 23 members across the state, all sorts of businesses, all sizes of businesses on all corners of the state. And we come at this issue from a commerce concern. We have a number of members who are relying upon efficient air travel for their employees. And are very concerned about Minnesota's noncompliance and the effect that that would have on their ability to their employees' ability to move about the country with commercially regulated air travel, starting as soon as a year from now in January 2018, and also have concerns with enforcement pieces of Real ID that are already in place, particularly those that prohibit somebody with a Minnesota driver's license from entering most federal facilities and military bases, things like that. You know, a number of our members also require their employees to have regular access to federal facilities, secure sites, things of that nature that is now made more difficult by Minnesota's noncompliance. So we appreciate the author's quick work to bring this back to the legislature. You know, we were very disappointed that the last session ended without final action on this matter to bring Minnesota into compliance. We recognize that now Minnesota has less time to bring itself into compliance, but we appreciate the quick work and look forward to being part of the solution going forward. So thank you very much for bringing us up today and for the opportunity to weigh in here.
Thank you. Any questions for this testifier? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Graves. Next, Mitch Killian with MAC. And for those of you that are new to the committee or new to the legislature, the MAC is the Minnesota Air Force or Airport Commission, guys.
Chair Scott and members.
Metropolitan, sorry. Go
Chair
ahead.
Scott and members, Mitch Killian with the Metropolitan Airports Commission. Thanks for the opportunity to testify. I think that, as you can imagine, we're here to support a resolution to this issue. Some have said that it may have an impact on us in the future if we don't fix this. I'm here to tell you that it's already having an impact on us out at the Airports Commission. As you can imagine, we continuously are out trying to search for new air service in our community, and that can be existing carriers that are already at our airport or new carriers adding service completely. And so when we're out there talking to carriers like JetBlue, they usually are planning 6 to 12 months in advance, and we have this thing out hanging over our head of whether or not our passengers are going to be able to get on airplanes or not. And it's true that you could maybe get a passport or you could do different things to become compliant, but a lot of our passengers are leisure travelers that are only traveling once or twice a year. Our largest growth area is in the Humphrey Terminal, Terminal 2, so Spirit Airlines and airlines like that. So a lot of those folks don't have passports and aren't planning to get them anytime soon. In fact, when they're debating their travels, oftentimes they're not debating whether or not they're going to fly on Northwest or our Delta or Spirit. They're kind of looking at surface transportation options, and throw this whole issue into the mix and they say, boy, it's so confusing, I'm not sure, I'm not going to take air travel. And it really is that types of decisions that are happening, and we're seeing it on our website regularly with confusion and people talking about it and saying, I'm not sure what this means for me, so I'm not going to travel.
for anybody that's traveled lately, you'll see that the TSA has now put up signs at our checkpoint saying, be prepared next year. If you don't have real ID, federally compliant, you're not going to be able to get on airplanes. So for us, this is a big issue. So what we want to do is support some type of resolution to this. Get to conference committee, get the governor and the Senate together, and let's see if we can't resolve this. Because as we get closer, I can tell you that when we're talking to airlines, they're probably not going to put an expensive new piece of equipment in this market with the question hanging over our head. So, again, it's all that we're here to do is support some type of resolution to this issue. And really, our website fills up our questions that come regularly for us. So thanks again, Madam Chair.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions, Representative Lash?
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Ms. Olson didn't know the answer to this question, so I'll ask you, since you're with the MAC, maybe you know. Last year we were at about 7 different deadlines that came and went that were the drop-dead deadlines. Do you know what number we're at now? How many deadlines there have been?
Mr. Killian?
Representative Lash, what I would say is no, I don't know. And I have followed this since it was originally created. We have a really good trade association, 2 of them, in fact, in Washington, D.C. They're K Street-type lobbyist groups, that American Council of Airport Executives and AAAE, the American Association of Airport Executives. And virtually the idea of trying to change the deadlines anymore in D.C. seems to have, people have given up, and that we're one of the last few that are left out there. So I understand that it's been moved and changed, but some have even said that the new administration might bring some proposal forward. I did some checking in the last week, and there's no movement out there on something changing on this at this time. Now, could they change the deadline again? That's very possible, but we're pretty concerned that this is at this point in time.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. The only reason I bring it up is this happens a lot around here when the feds say we have to do something and they set deadlines and they either follow through or they don't. But that's been the primary reason cited by a lot of proponents of this law is that we got to do it because, in fact, I got fired from my first conference committee on that. 0.08, I was going to wait until they denied us federal highway funds, and the Senate wanted to do it immediately, and I said there wasn't a reason because of the implementation costs. And this was the do-nothing session of 2005, I think, and Governor Pawlenty said, give me something to sign, anything. And so they fired me and the other Republican from the conference committee and put 2 people on who'd capitulate. My point is that this stuff happens all the time, and hanging over our heads, hey, we really got to do this because it's going to happen. It's still 2020, so that's all I'll say, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, Madam Chair, if I could add,
yes.
Madam Chair, Representative, in preparation for this, I have reached out to the Trump administration, the incoming administration, and I can confirm what was just said that there is there's no interest at this time in any capacity of altering this date, and we're one of 3 states left in the country for noncompliance. And I really do believe that the deadlines before us will be the last set.
Did he tweet that? I believe it if he tweeted it.
All right. Thank you. Further questions of Representative Dean?
Maybe it's because I lost the beard. Thank you, Madam Chair. So a quick question, and this is probably a simple question, but I'm assuming that a non-compliant ID the second tier in this bill, people wouldn't be able to get on a plane with that ID. Is that correct?
Mr. Killian.
That's our understanding. That's correct.
Okay, so they would either have to have an enhanced Minnesota ID or they would have to have a passport.
Mr. Killian.
A compliant ID with the new federal policy, an enhanced ID, or a passport.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Anyone else for this testifier? Thank you, Mr. Killian. Next is Gloria Stock Mickelson, and on deck is Ben Feist. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Gloria Stock Mickelson. I'm here today representing the American Society of Travel Agents. We have a very vested interest in this issue. Here in the state of Minnesota, we have 319 retail travel agencies that are selling travel to business and leisure travelers every day. Let me tell you, are we getting questions? We have large companies such as Carlson. We have smaller independent contractors that are selling travel. We have people like Birch Travel with 12 locations in the state of Minnesota, and we're getting questions every day from our travelers. We need to sell and service our customers. And to clarify some of the things that have been said, based on the Department of Homeland Security, which tells us what we're going to be able to do, starting January 22, 2018, travelers who do not have a license from a compliant state, which we are not, or a state that has been granted an extension, which we have not, will be asked to provide alternate acceptable identification, those being a U.S. passport, a trusted traveler document such as global entry, or third, a U.S. military ID. Those will be acceptable. If the traveler cannot provide an acceptable form of ID, they will not be permitted through security. That could mean January 22nd, we have travelers coming to the Minneapolis airport being turned away by TSA. We know our business travelers are pretty sophisticated, but yet I also know a whole lot of them personally that do not have those forms of ID. And as was said earlier, leisure travelers who go to Disney, who go to Las Vegas for the long weekend, will not have those IDs. And we today are coaching our travelers about this issue. We're encouraging U.S. passports, but we also know that this year is a busy year for the State Department. Everyone who got a passport 10 years ago to go to the Caribbean and Mexico all need renewals this year, which means the State Department is going to have a lot of passports to issue. So please take this issue seriously. It's very serious to our profession. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you said three IDs. One is the passport. One is the real
or the trusted compliant traveler, like global entry.
What is that?
It's a special program you go through. I have it, which does all the things Real ID. I do Social Security. I go through an interview. I go through fingerprinting to get that. It allows me into the United States when I travel internationally to go through a kiosk instead of the lines.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is that run by some government entity or is
U.S.
that
Customs?
We all learned something new there. Maybe some people were familiar with that. Any other questions for this testifier? Ms. Omar.
Madam Chair, I'm just wondering, would the enhanced ID qualify as something that could be used in lieu of the real ID?
Ms. Stock-Mickelson.
Correct. That's our understanding.
And what are the complications?
Representative Omar.
Chair, thank you. What are the complications that your travelers are facing with getting an enhanced ID?
They don't know about
Ms.
it.
Mickelson.
You know, we can tell them. They don't know where to go for it. It's just not understanding that it exists.
Yeah. Representative Omar, follow-up questions?
But that could be something that could be improved, communication
Absolutely.
Could be issued. And then I think just a follow-up on that. I know you said a passport is another option. So I have a passport ID. I don't know if you've seen one of those.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a faster process than the paper passport, and it costs a lot less.
Right.
And are people facing some complications with that as well?
No.
Okay.
It's just getting one or the other.
Sure. Yeah. Okay. So we do have some other options
yes.
To Real ID at this point for a lot of travelers, it sounds like. Okay. Thank you. Thank
you. You just need to take action fast.
Thank you. Any other questions for this testifier? Thank you for being here today. Mr. Feist, and then on deck, Reverend Grant Stevenson.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Ben Feist. I'm the legislative director for the ACLU of Minnesota. I first do want to thank Representative Smith for his hard work on this issue, and in particular, we do appreciate that this version involves a non-compliant license and that there's a mechanism for the legislature to revisit Real ID upon federal changes. As many of you know, the ACLU was a leader in opposition to Real ID going back to 2009 when Minnesota joined a majority of states in rejecting compliance. We believe that the Real ID Act itself is a bad law that should not have been passed in 2005, and it should be repealed or significantly modified by Congress. That said, we acknowledge that Minnesota is in a difficult position, as has been discussed today. When this issue reemerged back in 2015, Minnesota and three other states were singled out by the Department of Homeland Security as noncompliant. However, only 22 states were actually compliant at that time. The rest had been given discretionary extensions by DHS. So I think the idea of compliance has been thrown out of whack from time to time. At one point last year, Minnesota was listed by DHS as the only noncompliant state left. Now, there are actually eight. I just went on the website recently. So the number of noncompliant states is rising. It's not going the other direction. To date, only 25 states are technically compliant. The number of states that have extension and a number of states have extensions that are set to expire within the coming year. So it's possible, actually, that we could see more states becoming non-compliant rather than the other way around. And I think that's just important to bring up, since I believe that a lot of reports in the media have made this seem that Minnesota is really the only holdout left. And that simply doesn't seem to be the case. Rather, DHS is sort of moving the goalposts from time to time. So our primary concern with Real ID has always been its potential function as an internal passport or national ID card that could increasingly be used to track control. Like just taking one more moment of time here. I see that I've already run out. But I do want to make the point that we've always been concerned about this 50-state database issue. And that has been the primary concern for privacy advocates. Over the years, that provision was not implemented, and we have every reason to believe that any future administration can do that, because the law is still on the books, has not been repealed, and it would be very easy to reverse course, and we would have a 50-state interconnected database that has a host of privacy concerns. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Okay, Mr. Feist, any questions? Thank you for being here. Reverend Grant Stevenson, and on deck, Catalina Morales of Isaiah. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Grant Stevenson. I'm a Lutheran pastor in town. I'm with the Isaiah organization. And I'd like to talk about the line that was mentioned earlier, line 6.25. Representative Dean would like to offer, I think he called it a verbal amendment. And I'd like to speak in favor of that amendment. Many of us have been trying to restore driver's licenses to undocumented drivers ever since the ability to have a driver's license was taken away, which was in 2003 through an administrative rulemaking by a governor who hasn't held office in this state for 6 years. So this bill with line 6.25 would codify into law that rule for no reason. As you've heard the testimony here today, we're here talking about Real ID, a mandate from the federal government. So that means that voting this bill down is probably what has to happen unless Representative Dean's verbal amendment is accepted tonight. Eight states have issued Real ID while offering non-compliant driver's licenses to immigrants. But in Minnesota, here it is again, this issue of driver's licenses for immigrants snuck into a bill that's intended just to bring our state into compliance with new federal rules. This bill should have nothing to do with immigration. So I'm left to wonder why such vigilance against these neighbors. Why would we want all of our neighbors not to be able to drive with a license? Why wouldn't we want every driver in the state of Minnesota to have a pathway to buying insurance, which protects them and the rest of us who share the roads? If you're a person of faith, why would we stray so far from the scriptures in this? The demand from Leviticus that the foreigner in the land be treated as one of our own, or the center of the Christian gospel to make no distinctions but to treat everyone as a child of God. Or even if those values mean nothing to you, I think this speaks, Representative Lesh, to your point. I know that you know how the Minnesota economy works, that every undocumented worker is paying taxes. Every undocumented worker is paying taxes, paying into Social Security, and paying into Medicare, which they cannot benefit from. businesses like Sella Roofing, Bachman's, Bailey's, janitorial and cleaning and services, restaurant businesses, and countless others. These businesses operate much of their businesses with undocumented people who are wanted here, who are needed here, and who need to drive here. And so I ask myself, what is the constant need to refuse the most basic things to people who are wanted and needed and are building our communities with us? It feels like meanness. I know I'm at time, and I have 20 more seconds or less. I've come twice today because the right group of legislators couldn't get here on time this morning because of the snow, even though, as Representative Lesch points out, the auditorium was filled with people who care about this issue and figured out what time they needed to leave their house to get here in order to advocate for people that they care about. So I don't believe you're going to shut down these businesses, Sella and Bachman's and Bailey's. I don't believe that. They're a part of this community, and so are their employees. So we are better than this. This provision of the bill, as we move towards real ID, doesn't belong inside this bill, and I would encourage you to do whatever you need to do to take it out.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any questions for this testifier? Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, no, there's no question, but at this time I'd like to offer an oral amendment, and that would be on page 6, delete lines 24 and 25.
Representative Dean, because that oral amendment significantly changes the bill, I can't allow it.
Madam Chair, let me make a comment that this morning there was an oral amendment made to House File 83 in that amendment that significantly changed that bill. The word may have changed slightly, but it significantly changed that bill. So I would ask that you consider this amendment at this time so that we can have a conversation about that.
Representative Dean, the oral amendments I had were very insignificant compared to what this does to this bill. And there will be other opportunities. This bill's going to transportation after this. Someone can offer this amendment there and go through the right channels.
I have a question, Madam Chair. Relating to whether it's significant or not, I know you've made up your mind, but Ms. Olson told me she thought that that language was required by Federal Real ID. And I'm hearing from other people that it's not. So are there other people that can help clarify this?
Next speaker.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
If I could just get a clarification from research, too. They're ready to answer that at some point.
Mr. Burris, do you have the answer to that question?
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, there is a lawful status requirement for Real ID compliant card applications. That requirement wouldn't apply for non-compliant cards because the non-compliant, you know, the nature of it is not complying with all of the Real ID, the core Real ID requirements. I suspect that part of the question also hinges on the what would be proposed to go into statute as opposed to what's currently an administrative rule, and whether removal of some of the statutory language would, you know, whether administrative rules would stay in place. So at risk of confusing you further, the administrative rule right now around proof of residency, lawful presence, and identity would remain in place for non-compliant cards, and so lawful status would remain a requirement under those administrative rules.
But thank you, Madam Chair, but not in statute, right? So we're codifying in statute now that if I'm a student who overstays my visa or a worker overstays my visa and I'm wrangling to try to get it renewed or something and I still have to drive and I need an ID for that, under this law, where I could before, I'd be out of luck now. Is that under statute, is that correct?
Mr. Burris.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesch, yes, under the proposed language, somebody who could not demonstrate proof of temporary presence, lawful presence in the United States wouldn't be able to get either form of identification.
Okay, thank you. And I wonder if, Madam Chair, at some point,
Representative Lesh,
when the chamber came up here, or whatever business guy that was, said, yeah, let's just get this done. We've had enough of it. He didn't testify specifically as to that point, but I'd love to hear the chamber's opinion on that piece specifically at some point. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee, Ms. Morales. Go ahead and state your name for the tape and continue on.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catalina Morales. I am with ISAIAH. I'm here today to talk about line 6.25 that has been talked about. The reason this is important for me is I'm an immigrant. I'm 25 right now, and I've been an undocumented immigrant in this country for 22 years of those 25 years. Right now, I'm a DACA recipient, which gives me lawful status to work and go to school and drive, but that has to be renewed every 2 years, and it doesn't give me any pathway to citizenship, although I've been here all my life, and there's no way for me to legalize any documentation at all. And the reason I'm here is Donald Trump has attacked DACA recipients and has said that he will take away DACA for them and go after these DACA recipients. These are young people you're talking about that are going to school, working, taking out, you know, a lot of things in the economy, putting money into the economy, and I will soon be part of the group that will be targeted around this driver's license issue. So I am here today because I am asking you to remove this line, 6.25, from this bill. It shouldn't really be in this bill. The driver's license campaign can go through other means. What is happening right now is it's an effect of taking away driver's license from undocumented immigrants in 2003. And it was taken away by rule change. It wasn't taken away through the right process at that time. Now, if there's a dual way to do real ID, then that could be accessible to undocumented immigrants maybe in the future. So currently there is 8 states plus Washington, D.C. that have real ID and also have a driver's license that undocumented immigrants can receive. That's Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Nevada, New Mexico, Utah, and Vermont. I have spent my life here for these 22 years with my parents. They have been working for 22 years in this country without any documentation, and they have paid federal, state tax, Social Security, Medicare that they will never receive. I printed out a form from the IRS that can show that. The IRS asks you to have an ITIN number. It takes the place of a Social Security card, and we are forced to pay taxes every year. Now, that is thousands and thousands of dollars that we are paying into this government that we will never get back. The reality is that right now, if we don't have driver's license, we cannot drive, and we are driving without taking a test. We are driving without having any permission around that or insurance, and we are putting into this economy through businesses. I would also like to hear from the Chamber of Commerce, since we are the working force of this country. We are 95,000 undocumented immigrants in Minnesota who need a driver's license. Thank you.
Any questions for this testifier?
Yes.
Representative Dean.
thank you, Madam Chair. So you work and you pay taxes?
Yes.
And you currently have a valid driver's license?
Yes.
Ms. Morales.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm assuming if DACA is not renewed, when you go to renew your status, you will not be renewed according to what's been spoken about at the federal level?
No.
Ms. Morales.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So you said 21 of your 23 years you were not a citizen?
22 of my 25.
22. Okay. Sorry. Lots of numbers. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm assuming you went to school, you were part of a community, your family was engaged in the community, contributing to the community well-being and health and culture?
Of course, yes. I started school here, kindergarten here, and English was the first language I actually mastered instead of Spanish. And I have been, my faith is Catholic, and I have been very involved in my church. You guys all have a letter from the Chamber, the Catholic Conference of Bishops of Minnesota, urging you to take away this line from this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And as I'm thinking about this, I'm thinking about some of the earlier testimony. Currently, you can get on a plane.
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm assuming that if you lose your status and are not able to get an ID, you will at that time be non-compliant. You won't be able to get on a plane.
That's correct.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And even if you did lose that status and you were able to get a non-compliant ID so you could drive, pay insurance, try to do the right thing in Minnesota, you would still not be able to get on a plane.
Ms. Morales.
No, I wouldn't. That's
correct. Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. So this really isn't an issue about safety of flying.
No.
Because a non-compliant ID would not allow you to get on a plane.
That's correct.
Thank you, and thank you, Madam Chair. A few more questions here. So you had mentioned that it's 95,000 undocumented individuals in our state that are currently involved, whether that's in education, whether that's involved in working, contributing to our state budget as far as the taxes that they're contributing, and as you mentioned, are unable to get those taxes back. And Madam Chair, and this is just my own ignorance, but doesn't ITIN allow you the opportunity to file your state taxes and then get a refund from the state of Minnesota for those taxes paid?
Ms. Morales.
It depends, Madam Chair, Committee. It depends how many dependents you have and all of that. But when you file with an ITIN number, you do not get back the refund that you should get back because you are filing with an ITIN number and not a Social Security number. That's said to you when you go file your taxes.
Okay.
17.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Another question. So in other words, we're already treating non-documented folks differently within our system because of the inability to have a Social Security number, but using an ITIN, they can participate at some level of working and contributing, but it's, again, it's a different level than all of us that are citizens.
Yes. There's a big amount of economic abuse happening to the immigrant community because of this ITIN number that they receive and don't get any of the money they put in.
Okay.
Representative Dean.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. So, you know, I'm a little bit aware of what happens on Fridays sometimes in the Latino communities throughout our state, and can you say if you know of these incidents that I've heard of people that, you know, because of what we do with some of our undocumented neighbors, many of them operate in a cash system. And in that cash system, we have businesses that are, quite frankly, taking advantage of these individuals by paying them sub-minimum wage, hourly wages that are below the minimum wage, and oftentimes paying in cash.
Representative Dean, I've given you a lot of liberty, but I'm... Yeah. This doesn't really have anything to do, this line of questioning in particular doesn't have anything to do with the bill in front of us.
Well, I think it has a little bit to do with the bill in front of us, Madam Chair, because of line, 6.24 and 6.25. And I just, I want to make a point that Fridays are a very dangerous time for a lot of people in the Latino community because oftentimes they are mugged and they are robbed. And we're now... talking about, we're not trying to rectify the situation. If anything, we're actually trying to make it worse. And I think it needs to be incumbent upon all of us to think about not just what we're doing here to immigrants, but what the implication that's going to have out in our communities. Because it's going to be significant. And I think it's real easy to sit in and say, well, you know, everybody should have a document and everybody should be here legally. And by the way, I don't mean legally. Everybody should be here on legal status. And it's going to have a huge, huge impact. And I think we're going to have many, many long conversations about what this is going to mean, not just to those individuals that we're denying the ability to drive and pay insurance and making our roads safe, but it's going to impact a lot of our communities. And in some ways, it's going to impact our communities in rural Minnesota more, where we actually have many, many non-documented people that are working in businesses throughout rural Minnesota. So I'm disappointed that you were not willing to take the oral amendment today, and we'll continue to have these conversations moving forward. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dean. Other questions for this testifier? Thank you, Ms. Morales. Twyla Braze. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. My name is Twyla Braze. I'm president and co-founder of Citizens Council for Health Freedom. We have long opposed Real ID and are fully supportive of the 2009 Minnesota law currently in place prohibiting implementation of Real ID. This committee exists to protect the constitutional and data privacy rights of Minnesotans, and it's also charged with protecting 10th Amendment rights of the state and its residents not to be commandeered by the federal government. We believe enacting this bill to give the federal government control is a voluntary abdication of the legislature's obligation to protect Minnesotans against unconstitutional federal encroachment and federal control over identification, movement, and access to services. First, I'd like to draw your attention to the $3,000 cost. 1 year ago, Illinois said that it would cost $60 million over 2 to 3 years to bring their state into compliance. Since we have never implemented Real ID, this is an astonishingly low figure for us. I'd also like to talk about the word compliant. It's not really a compliant and non-compliant license, no matter what the wording in the law says. Real ID includes both for federal purposes and not for federal purposes licensures. It means that the state has to comply for both of those. So there is, as Senator Dibble said last year, no way to really opt out of it because they're all under it. So even under a two-tier system, both licenses are controlled and regulated by the Department of Homeland Security once a state complies. Regarding official purposes and the federal change section of the law on 4.15, it appears to give the state control over federal encroachment, but we disagree. As soon as the Department of Homeland Security decides to have a new official purpose for the Real ID, it is not that the state has anything to do about it. So the language says that the state will not comply. But the state doesn't have to comply. Because as soon as they say that the new official purpose is ammunition, the gun shops will comply. As soon as they say the new official purpose is access to health care, the clinics and hospitals will comply. It has nothing to do with the state, so that is not comfort language. Section 7 adds a perjury, which has a penalty of 5 years in prison or $10,000 or both. We don't think that we have that today on driver's licenses, but I could be corrected. The security features under federal control in 14.26, because the federal government controls it, they could decide to add face, palm, fingerprint, or iris scans for Minnesota licenses and IDs. When you go to Section 19, it prohibits data sharing for the not-for-federal-purposes licenses or IDs. But, however, the Real ID Act of 2005 says, and I quote, that the state must provide electronic access to all other states to information contained in the motor vehicle database of the state. So that means all the data for any of the licenses, and this is therefore not protective. Then we go to Section 21 on 19.4, which says the commissioner must fully comply with the Real ID Act, including its regulations, and that means fully, not partially, so anything that the state decides to do won't be done. And so to summarize, we'd like to be clear that Minnesota never needs to comply. And more states, indeed, are not complying. There are 5 deadlines that have come and gone, as Representative Lesch has said, and Homeland Security admits that you can fly without Real ID. TSA gives 13 IDs and says you don't need an ID to fly. And so we oppose the federalization of the identification movement and access to products and services that this bill would allow. And this, we want to just note, this is a national ID card. We don't have to comply. And this is a violation of constitutional rights, and so we ask you to vote no. Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Braze? Thank you for your testimony. Henry Jimenez. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the record and go ahead with your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Henry Jimenez. J.I. Jimenez, and committee members and Representative Smith. We're only concerned with 6.25 as well. There's, you know, every bill that gets introduced in the House and in the Senate is important to the Latino community, but this line in particular has a significant impact on our Latino community. Ms. Morales mentioned that there's about 95,000 undocumented immigrants, and we estimate that 30,000 to 45,000 are Latino. And so obviously that line would be significantly impacting our Latino community, and we would ask that the committee consider striking that line as well.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for this testifier? Thank you for being here for your testimony. Is there anyone else in the audience wishing to testify?
Please come forward. Thank you for being here. Go ahead with your testimony after you state your name, please.
My name is Susan Moss, and I'm an Episcopal priest, and I serve Mission Santo Niño Jesus, not far from here. It's a Latino mission of the Episcopal Church in Minnesota. I want to say I appreciate all your hard work and your efforts. However, I, too, would like to speak in favor of deleting 6.25 in this bill. Santo Niño, my church is full of hardworking people, laborers, cleaners, hospitality employers, roofers, carpenters, child care workers who need to drive to work every day, serving the people of Minnesota and, yes, paying taxes. I actually had, believe it or not, work scheduled on my roof today, but was canceled because of the snowstorm. And I noticed also the number of people in my neighborhood who were having their alleys plowed and their sidewalks plowed. Maybe that's happening in your neighborhood today too. Perhaps someone from my church shoveled your alley today. Perhaps a member of my church on the treacherous highways this morning were taking their kids to school. Perhaps you passed one of our young adults, proud graduate of a Minnesota high school, who was driving on her way to classes at Augsburg College. They all want to drive safely. I want them to drive safely. I know you want them to drive safely as we travel Minnesota roads. On my way here this morning for the hearing, I saw many accidents on 94. A lot of us were late because of crazy weather conditions that affected our roads. God forbid that you or I or any member of my congregation should be involved in an accident, but if that happens, we all must have insurance. So in the name of public safety for all of us, including members of my congregation who are on their way to work or the store or to school or the Twins game or wherever, in all of our many counties, I ask that you support the deletion of 625 in this bill. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Is there any questions for this testifier? Thank you for being here. Anyone else wishing to testify? Seeing no one. Representative Smith, I'll give you the last word. Oh, I'm sorry, member question.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. I was actually speaking with nonpartisan staff as well as department staff based on some of the questions and conversations about line 6.25. And this question is actually for Representative Smith. So, Representative Smith, I understand that to be compliant with the Real ID, you have to have the ability, the state has to have the ability to do a lawful status check. But there is no requirement that lawful status be required as the alternative license or the non-compliant license. If you do a statutory construction analysis of this proposal, I believe the way you have this drafted, that it is your intention to have that lawful status section apply to both the Real ID and the non-compliant statute status license. Is that your intention? Because I believe that is the concern of folks here. They understand that the Real ID has to have a status issue, but their concern is with the non-compliant license. And my question is, as the author of this bill, is it your intention to have lawful status be checked for both the compliance and non-compliance license reflected in statute?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, my intent of this legislation is for the current rules to be followed for the non-compliant license as it is today to be followed tomorrow once this bill is enacted.
Madam Chair. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Representative Smith, is there a reason why you felt that the rule that's currently applied actually had to be incorporated into the statute?
Representative Smith.
Madam Chair, Representative, for sake of simplicity and to follow the current law that has been followed since 2003, that is the reason and the intent behind the language that's included.
Representative Hillstrom?
Madam Chair, I just wanted to make it clear that that's in fact what this proposal does, is it makes it in statute that both the Real ID, which requires it, and the non-compliant statute, or the non-compliant license, would now have the requirement in the statute that status be checked.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just commenting, I can't support this bill as long as it puts into statute that the Real ID non-compliant Minnesota driver's licenses can't be issued to our undocumented neighbors. I think it's a very unfortunate policy choice, and it's certainly worth a no vote just on that basis.
Just a statement. Thank you. Representative Smith, any final comments?
Yes, Madam Chair, members, thank you for the discussion today, and thank you for staying late so we could get this bill through. I appreciate the good and thorough discussion. I look forward to continuing this discussion as this bill moves through the legislative process. Last session, we started this bill, and really a pooch punt is what happened, and the bill did not get completed. I respectfully ask for your support on this bill so we can move forward and bring some consistency to the significantly impaired commerce that's going to be imparted upon our state if we do not get this passed. Thank you very much, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, point of parliamentary inquiry.
Representative Lesh.
What is a pooch punt?
Representative Smith, do you want to define that for the group here?
Madam Chair, Representative, it is a term used when something falls short of its original intent or goal.
Well, thank you.
Representative Hillstrom.
Madam Chair, I'd ask for a roll call.
All right. Representative Hillstrom.
Can I get clarification on where this goes next?
Yes, it's going to transportation. Policy. All right. A roll call has been requested. The clerk will take the roll on House File 3.
Representative Scott.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Lesh.
No.
Representative Carlson.
No.
Representative Dean.
No.
Representative Hillstrom.
No.
Representative Howie.
Representative Howe.
Howe, excuse me.
Aye.
You get two votes.
Representative Johnson.
No.
Representative Lunin?
Yes.
Representative Omar?
No.
Representative O'Neill?
Yes.
Representative Vogel?
Yes.
Representative Whalen?
Yes.
The vote is 7-6 in favor. The bill passes and is re-referred to the Committee on Transportation and Regional Governance.